Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. Photo by Mary Cantrell. David Beebe, Democratic candidate for Presidio County Commissioner Precinct 4, who beat out his opponent Frank Buddy Knight in the primary election on Tuesday, sits across from the Marfa Visitor Center to greet voters and passersby. Beebe was encouraging contacts in his phone to come out and vote via text and was optimistic about the race. Here are the 2022 primary election results for Presidio County by Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. On Tuesday, Presidio County joined the rest of the state in voting in the primary election, with voters casting their ballots for a slew of candidates to represent both parties in the general election this November. With the exception of the Precinct 4 County Commissioner race, in which Gary Wilbanks was unopposed in the Republican primary, there are no Republican candidates in the local races, meaning the Democratic victors will likely assume the positions come November. County Judge. Incumbent Judge Cinderella Guevara, who recently switched to the Republican Party, and Democrat Jose Portillo Jr. were both unopposed in their respective primaries. Guevara garnered a total of 90 votes, while Portillo received 835 votes. The two will face off in the general election this fall. County Commissioner Precinct 4. David Beebe, former Justice of the Peace for Precinct 1, has beat incumbent Frank Buddy Knight with 58.95% of the vote, receiving a total of 280 versus Knight's 195. Beebe will face off against Republican Gary Wilbanks, co-founder and principal at Teal System, in the general election. Wilbanks earned a total of 34 votes in the Republican primary. County Commissioner Precinct 2, Margarito Hernandez, current Presidio Chief of Police, comes in ahead with 52.62% of the vote at 171 votes, with opponent Abel Billy Hernandez, a member of Presidio City Council, at 154 votes. Margarito Hernandez has said he will be able to continue as Chief of Police while also serving as County Commissioner. Justice of the Peace Precinct 1. Dina Jo Marquez, who had stepped in to finish out predecessor David Beebe's term, has beat Marfa City Council member Raul Lara by only 8 votes at a final tally of 300 versus 292, meaning Marquez garnered 50.68% of the vote. Justice of the Peace Precinct 2. Incumbent Juanita Urias Bishop won with 61.58% of the vote at 460 votes, with opponent Brenda Pondo Covos, assistant to the county attorney, finishing with 287 votes. County Treasurer. Democrat and incumbent Francis Garcia, who ran unopposed, received a total of 709 votes, while Republican David Chavez, who also ran unopposed, received a total of 86 votes. The two will face off in the general election this fall. County District Clerk, Democrat incumbent Forsita Zubia, ran unopposed for a county district clerk and received a total of 842 votes. Party chairs. Also running unopposed was Republican County Chair Dan Dunlap, who received a total of 78 votes. Acting Democratic County Chair Nicole Schwartz did not appear on the ballot, according to the clerk's office and a sample ballot. Schwartz said her absence on the ballot was due to her not being a registered voter in the county in time for the candidate filing period, but she will continue to act as the appointed Democratic County Chair going forward. Statewide races. For U.S. Representative District 23, John Lira won the Democratic primary against opponent Priscilla Golden. In Presidio County, however, more voters cast their ballots for Golden, who received 58.51% of the vote, with 512 votes across the county, versus Lira's 363. In the Republican primary, incumbent Ernest Tony Gonzalez emerged victorious by a large margin. In Presidio County, 78.18% of voters went for Gonzalez, who received a total of 86 votes, more than opponents Alia Garcia and Alma Arredondo Lynch, who received 14 and 10 votes, respectively. In the race for Texas governor, Democrat Beto O'Rourke is poised to face off against incumbent Greg Abbott in the general election this November. 70.86% of Presidio County voters in the Democratic primary voted for O'Rourke, who received 727 votes in the county. 66.1% of Presidio County voters in the Republican primary voted for Abbott, who received 78 votes in the county. At MISD, new members' resignations and facility updates by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. The Marfa Independent School District boardroom was abuzz Monday night as board members, staff, and students clutching trifold poster boards shuffled into the crowded room where nearly every plastic school chair was occupied. New board. The meeting began with a jump to new business, the cancellation of the May 7th general election. Traditionally held in conjunction with the city's city council election, the joint election will be canceled this year due to a lack of candidates. Superintendent Oscar Aguero said they had exactly 4 applicants for the 4 open slots. Current board members Teresa Nunez and Ernie Villarreal will keep their positions. Katie Price Folks, who resigned from the board last month, was originally going to stay on the board until April, but she and Sean Bruguette resigned effective this week in order to be replaced by 2 new board members. The board unanimously accepted their resignations. Aguero said that there were a few options moving forward, but his recommendation was to appoint the new board members as soon as possible in order to have a full 8-person board. Lori Flores, the city utilities clerk who previously served on the school board, and Ruben Martinez, the father of Marfa ISD 8th grader, and maintenance tech crew chief with the Texas Highways Department, will be filling in for Price Folks and Bruguette, respectively. Martinez, Nunez, and Villarreal will be sworn in for their 3-year terms in May. Flores will also be re-sworn in come May to serve the remainder of Price Folks' term, which is up in May 2023. Their appointment passed unanimously among the council, and they were sworn in by the superintendent's secretary, Griselda Hinojos, who delivered the oath of office. The freshly sworn-in members then took their seats at the board table to a round of applause from meeting attendees. All board members were now present. Presentations, science fair, facilities. Next, the meeting advanced to the reports from staff, with high school principal Allison Scott honoring the students whose presentations recently advanced to the National Science Fair. Alexis Gonzalez, Juan Avila, and Aubrey Aguilar showed off their project, Germs and You, to the board. Aguilar also received fourth place in a University Interscholastic League, UIL, film competition for her short film, Heartbeat, Scott said. Next to present to the board was Clint Alsobrook, regional manager with Texas Association of School Boards. He walked the board through an online educational facility services dashboard, which graded the district's facilities on many levels, from ADA compliance to safety and security. The dashboard outlined priority projects, which included HVAC upgrades, as well as roof repair and associated costs. Also, Brooke said many school facilities were operating with over 15-year-old equipment. The HVAC, plumbing, you've got units that are past their anticipated life, so it's something that does need to be addressed relatively quick, said also Brooke. School security, HVAC. Aguero then discussed the ongoing issue of district infrastructure upgrades from school security to HVAC replacement. Aguero said while they will be taking nearly $1 million out of their fund balance account for the new track, they will likely need to tap into fund balance again for some of the major infrastructure repairs that are needed for the facilities. The elementary school is unable to open windows, he said, as he gave board members a heads up that expenses were on the horizon. I do believe in the next few years we will be lowering our fund balance to be able to fix some things to make improvements. I just want you to know that I'm probably going to come to you about spending money, said Aguero. He said the district has $350,000 budgeted for maintenance this cycle that they should start using for such projects. It might be possible to use ESSER, E-S-S-E-R, funds, COVID relief grant monies for HVAC repairs, but restrictions on how to use those funds are tricky, said Aguero. Aguero said an estimate to upgrade locks on both campuses came out to $200,000, and security camera upgrades were coming in around $28,000, not including both gyms. The option to put up fencing around both campuses came up in order to create one entry and one exit and cut down on the numerous access points. The elementary school has a total of 8 entrances and the high school a total of 15. So let's say we go out and go perimeter, one entrance, one exit. We could cut down the cost on the locks, said board member Renee Gonzalez. A fence, which Aguero said would cost around $100,000 to $150,000, would allow them time to save money for the next layer of security, he suggested. But fencing off the brand new track to resident use didn't make sense, said Aguero. In the end, no decisions on new security were made, but most voiced support for the fence concept. Superintendent's report. Aguero then reported 3 active COVID cases across both campuses and said the school would continue performing vaccination clinics and testing. The district's website is now tracking COVID cases, but hasn't been updated since late January, which Aguero said he would remedy. The board then reviewed the 2020-2021 school report cards generated by the Texas Education Agency. The grade the school receives incorporates financial information, academic performance reports, and accountability ratings, according to the TEA's website. The school received a 62% rating for the 2020-2021 academic year. Schools were not rated in 2019-2020, but in 2018-2019, the school received an 87%. The 62% is classified as approaches expectations, not meets expectations, the desired benchmark. Aguero said it was important to consider the numerous changes brought on by the pandemic, but the score needs to improve in the future. "I'm not disappointed. I'm not thrilled, because we can do better, and the staff knows we can do better," said Aguero. "This is just kind of the benchmark of where we're at. I think it's a good benchmark. I think it's a true benchmark. I think we'll be exceeding it this year." J.E. Gregg Auditorium renovation. Similar to the track overhaul, a renovation of the district's auditorium has been long discussed, said Aguero, and now was the time to act. He said auditorium upgrades would signal that the district cares about all students, not just student athletes. "Not every kid is going to be super excited that we got a brand new track. It's a different thing that says, hey, look, now we have this to perform in," said Aguero. Bianca Gonzalez, business specialist with MISD, was present at the meeting to present her findings on what an auditorium renovation would look like. "The existing auditorium is not suiting the needs of the students," she said, "and one of the major upgrades to the space would be to lengthen the stage so it is the proper size for one-act plays. Also on the wish list are new seats, a new floor, lighting and sound upgrades, electrical upgrades, plus a new HVAC. Many alumni in the room recalled the unchanging 80s sound equipment and stagnation of the performance space. Seat removal estimates were coming in at $14,500, with the cost of new seats and installation totaling around $65,000. Gonzalez was still working on a flooring estimate, she said. "New seats, floors, and lengthening the stage are the primary objects for the immediate future. The ideal timeline would be to start the project in the spring or summer and complete it in time for one-act play season next December," said Gonzalez. "There is an available $8,700 donation for the project, but the board would like to raise additional money and will likely take $71,000 out of fund balance for the effort." Aguero said money raised could possibly be put back into fund balance. "Maybe they could offer commemorative plaques or host a fundraising event," some said, "and partner with boosters and PTO. Nunez said a nice new auditorium would help boost students' pride in their school. Others commented on the auditorium as a space for visitors, similar to the track. Scott said the high school's one-act play program garnered a lot of interest this year, and students would only be more attracted to participating in performing arts with an upgraded facility. "I think having that auditorium will build that enthusiasm even more," said Scott. Mixed news. Teacher housing resignations. The board, prompted by Villarreal, discussed rental fees for teaching living in district-provided housing. There was discussion of lowering rent for the homes, and Aguero said they would readdress the matter when leases are up in May. In contrast to the start of the meeting, only board members and a couple of staff members remained when the board reconvened from a lengthy executive session. Board Secretary Nunez announced they would accept the resignations of teachers Melanie Harms and Amy Mackey, effective at the end of the 2022 school year, and the meeting adjourned. Child endangerment case proceeds to grand jury. Fort Stockton man held without bond, by Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Alpine. Hector Flores Jr., a Fort Stockton resident currently facing child endangerment charges after he and his daughter went missing in Big Bend National Park, was denied bail at a court hearing on Friday, with the presiding judge deciding his case will proceed to a grand jury. Flores has been detained in Brewster County Jail since February 15th, the day after he and his 9-year-old daughter were found in Mexico after having gone missing in the national park 10 days prior. The two were found near Boquillas del Carmen, a significant distance away from Flores' vehicle that was found abandoned on Old Ore Road. Investigators found they had made the journey on foot, and the child had gone roughly 2 weeks without food. Flores' initial preliminary court hearing last Wednesday saw Judge David Fannin of the U.S. District Court, Western District of Texas, presiding over the case, with criminal defense attorney Shane O'Neill representing Flores and Assistant U.S. Attorney Scott Greenbaum representing the government. Special Agent Alice Downey of the FBI was brought in to testify in the case, and while additional details were revealed regarding the events leading up to the disappearance, including that Flores seemed to have planned the disappearance well in advance, the judge had not yet made a decision regarding Flores' bond. When Flores' preliminary hearing reconvened on Friday, February 25th, the judge ultimately ordered he would be detained without bond. Since the court met on Wednesday, Judge Fannin said he had time to consider the situation and review evidence. Judge Fannin recounted the series of events. Flores pulled L.F. out of school, allowed his phone to be disconnected, left Fort Stockton without notifying friends or family, abandoned his vehicle and multiple forms of identification in the national park, and avoided detection while crossing into Mexico illegally. These factors led him to determine the only way to ensure Flores would appear in further court proceedings was to detain him without bond. He said Flores' actions can be deemed as ill-considered, reckless, and put his 9-year-old daughter's safety in jeopardy. The judge cited Downey's testimony, which said Flores went to extreme lengths to avoid apprehension, all the while exposing his daughter to the elements and not providing adequate food. The court first discussed Flores' housing options should he be released on bond, with Flores' attorney O'Neill arguing for his release under the condition he find a suitable residence. Between pretrial services, determining his previous address unsuitable, and O'Neill presenting the option of a halfway house in Midland with an available bed mid-March, Flores' housing situation was unresolved and ill-timed, leaving a gap in housing from potential release to the halfway house, which presented concerns for Greenbaum. Additionally, pretrial services did not confirm whether or not he could be employed back at the Fort Stockton supermarket where he previously worked. A grand jury will decide whether to bring an indictment against Flores, at which point he will either plead guilty or go to trial. The U.S. Attorney's Office did not respond to requests for comment regarding this case. Flores' attorney O'Neill did not return a request for comment. City Council hears citizen presentations, discusses property sale and future of the council in latest assembly. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa, the last City Council meeting of the month, held last week in Marfa City Hall's Kasner Room, was well attended by Marfa citizens, with council members hearing multiple presentations and, along with usual business, discussing the future of the governing body, which will see two council members, Buck Johnston and Yosef Ben Yehuda, exit office early this summer. Present at the February 24th meeting were City Manager Mandy Roan, City Attorney Teresa Todd, Council members Johnston, Ben Yehuda, and Raul Lara, with Mayor Pro Tem Irma Salgada leading the meeting in Mayor Manny Baeza's absence. Council member Eddie Payaras was also absent. Historic District designation for downtown Marfa. Caitlin Murray, Director of Archives and Programs at the Judd Foundation, discussed the designation of downtown Marfa as a nationally recognized Central Historic District. Murray gave a summary of the project and stated news from the National Park Service should come in March or April regarding the official designation. The boundaries of the Central Marfa Historic District are Washington Street to the north, Dallas Street to the south, Dean and Russell Streets to the east, and Austin and Abbott Streets to the west. A draft of the proposal is available online. In addition to the honorific status, which could allow the city to conduct historic walking tours and other programming, the designation also opens up funds for buildings within the boundary to receive federal and state tax credits on restoration projects that honor the original structures. Historic buildings not within the boundary of the Central District can still apply to be part of the National Register, said Murray. The National Register of Historic Places already recognizes Marfa's Fort D.A. Russell, Hotel Vice Paisano, and Blackwell School. They've already acknowledged a lot of key, really important sites in Marfa, so this is kind of another expansion of that, just drawing attention to how important Marfa is, said Murray. While City Hall will not be a part of the historic district because it is a city-owned facility, Councilmember Johnson did mention she'd like to see the building painted soon. She said it has been budgeted for, and because the city is approaching its six-month mark in the fiscal year, she would like to get it on the agenda and get it done. Others agreed. It would be nice to paint it more historical like it used to be, said Todd. Council votes to approve sale of city property to resident in encroachment case. Next, council took up old business, starting with the petition by Marfa resident Concepcion Campos to purchase approximately 234 square feet of East Lincoln Street, on which her adobe home and front porch are encroaching. A survey was conducted which notified Campos of the 3.9-foot encroachment. Now, in order to sell her property to an interested buyer, she must purchase the area of encroachment from the city. Since council last met, the city obtained the signatures from Campos' neighbors that were needed to proceed with the sale. Council ultimately voted to approve the sale. Campos must now provide the city with a survey and an appraisal, and a public hearing was set for 6 p.m. on March 31st at City Hall. While council members decided how to handle this specific sale, it was brought up by multiple parties that these incidents were likely to keep occurring, and it would be good to set a precedent for the future so the new council has clearer guidelines. I think it's just going to keep popping up as homes because normally they were going from family member to family member, so we didn't know. But now that they are being sold outside the family, we're getting the surveys, said Roan. The whole block is off by 3 to 4 feet, Todd said, and it's not the only area with encroachments in the city, stated Councilmember Johnston. She questioned whether there was a way to understand the scale of the issue rather than just dealing with encroachments on a case-by-case basis, to which Roan said it wouldn't be feasible to get a survey of every city lot. Johnston was concerned these sales would not benefit the city financially, she said. Ben Yehuda questioned whether there could be an alternative to selling the land in order to avoid perpetuating an offset in property lines. He and Johnston were concerned about giving the impression that if a structure is built in the wrong place, the city will simply sell the land to the person in violation. Todd said an encroachment agreement might be a possible alternative, but city staff are limited and she didn't think the few encroachment agreements they currently hold were being collected on. The thing about the encroachment agreements is you have to have somebody stay on top of that, said Todd. Johnston agreed the idea to do an encroachment agreement was valid, but thought it would be ill-received. There was also discussion regarding what the future owners intend to do with the property and how that might affect the sale. For example, if new owners decided to tear down the porch or entire structure, an encroachment would no longer exist. The 234 square feet in question does not contain city utilities, noted Roan and Todd, meaning the city does not require regular access to the area, making the sale simpler. Salgado ultimately made a motion to approve the sale, stating council can worry about setting the precedent later, but out of concern for holding up Campos' sale, should let this one go. Johnston advocated for not waiting. We're setting the precedent for moving forward, this one to do it, because this is the one that encroaches probably the most on that block as far as structure, said Johnston. Ben Yehuda said he didn't like the pressure to make a quick decision and that an interested buyer would still be around 2 weeks later. He said he felt his solution to do an encroachment agreement didn't seem to garner much support, but agreed this would be a good case in which to set the precedent for the whole block. You're presuming that everyone who comes after you will follow your precedent and not want to do their own, said Todd, alluding to the two council members leaving office soon to make way for their replacements. Ben Yehuda said the matter touched on one of the primary challenges of serving on city council. To a certain level, we often try to make decisions, balancing the specifics of the situation and having a mindset to the future and the past to try to be fair and treat everybody the same. And that's tough, said Ben Yehuda. After more back-and-forth discussions, Salgado reminded council there was already a motion made by her to approve the sale on the table, which had been seconded by Councilmember Lara, to which Ben Yehuda ultimately voted yay and Johnston voted nay. Tourism, infrastructure, mobile app, Marfa and Presidio County Museum, Chinati sewer pipes. Director of Tourism Abby Boyd gave updates regarding a new mobile app for Marfa visitors. While it was originally thought the project might be funded by an Economic Development Administration, EDA, grant, Boyd, who is now serving on the board of the Texas Mountain Trail Historic Commission, said the organization is looking into options that would fund the project in its entirety. Council members also discussed a request for qualifications, RFQ, for engineering services for the Marfa and Presidio County Museum. The RFQ is fairly simple and requires engineers to have past experience working in the area and with historic buildings, said Roan. At the last council meeting, it was established that the initial assessment by an engineer would serve as a roadmap for future repairs, and the city would work from a list the engineer provided to improve the structure over time. Council approved the RFQ. Serendipitously, Chinati Foundation Director Ginny Moore was present at the meeting, and in lieu of going into executive session to discuss aging sewer pipes on Chinati property, for which the city has received violations from the Texas Center on Environmental Equality, Moore spoke with City Attorney Teresa Todd and City Engineer Ramon Carrasco to schedule a meeting in order to discuss the matter soon. City Manager's Report, Website and Water Tank Updates. Lastly was the City Manager's Report. During her report, Roan said the city's new website is nearly complete and staff is currently being trained on the incoming system. The website redo will include the utilities portal. Roan said the new software should be fully up and running by this summer. Ron also reported the city's new water tank, originally slated to be completed this March, will likely not be completed until November due to delays. Public Works Director Chuck Salgado said the project has experienced multiple challenges, including equipment and chemical delays. He said he has been regularly patching the current tank, which is leaking, but it should hold up until November. Costs for the project haven't gone up yet, but may, Roan said. After council member updates in which outgoing council members promised to stay involved, Ben Yehuda said he would remain on the Presidio Council Appraisal District Board, and Johnston said she had interest in the Planning and Zoning Board. The meeting concluded. Councilmember Lara's motion to adjourn was seconded by Councilmember Johnston with a definitive, "I'll second that, baby."
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. Cood Lujan to have primary runoff by Nathan Heuer. Two of the three local contested races for this year's primary election were decided on March 1st, and one will be added to a runoff in May. The Democratic candidate race for Justice of the Peace Precinct 1 proved to be the tightest, as incumbent Ruben Salinas defeated Oscar Gallegos by 6 votes. Salinas trailed 220 to 216 after early votes were reported. The district clerk race was the lone contested race, with 3 candidates vying for 1 nomination, meaning that the winner needed to get 50% of the vote plus 1 to secure the nomination without a runoff. Darla Coode received 41% of the votes, and Tammy Lujan received 31% of the votes. Election day for primary runoff elections is scheduled for May 24th. Early voting begins May 16th and runs through May 20th. Coode and Lujan will be the lone local runoff election. Nathan Reeves won the Republican nomination for county commissioner with 62% of the vote. At the district level, Tony Gonzalez received 72% for Representative U.S. Representative District 23. On the Democratic ballot, Priscilla Golden received the most votes in Pecos County for U.S. Representative District 23 with 52%. Republican Andrew Moore tallied the most votes for State Representative District 53 with 61%. For governor of Texas, Republican Greg Abbott received 70% of the vote in Pecos County, and Beto O'Rourke received 70% of the Democratic ballots. School board candidates made official by Nathan Heuer. Candidates running for the Fort Stockton ISD School Board in the upcoming May election were made official last week. Two of the three wards that are up for vote will have contested races. Ward 2 will feature 3 candidates on the May ballot. Alfredo R. Freddy Martinez will run against Felix G. Rodriguez Jr. and Valerie Bruno. Ward 4 will be 2-candidate race between incumbent Sandra Rivera and Gloria Ortiz. Anastasio Dominguez is running for Ward 3 and is unopposed. Voting day for the May election is scheduled for May 7th. Springs Fest to celebrate Comanche Springs history. Until they were pumped dry in the 1960s, Comanche Springs was among Texas' 6 largest springs, flowing at least 30 million gallons a day into the dry earth of Pecos County. The springs created a desert oasis that earned Fort Stockton the title of Spring City and renowned across West Texas. It also supported dozens of farms that grew pecans, alfalfa, and luscious melons, known far and wide as Pecos cantaloupes. On Saturday, March 12, Springs Fest will celebrate this history and attempt to gather more of it with an event at the historic Annie Riggs Museum from 2 to 5:30 p.m. The celebration will include a tour of the springs, which have recently begun flowing again in the late winter months when the aquifer rebounds from summer irrigation pumping. Highlights will include oral historians on hand to capture memories of Comanche Springs from anyone who remembers when they flowed year-round. Another team will be on hand to scan and digitize any photographs that individuals may have of the springs flowing. An exhibit at the Annie Riggs Museum that will showcase the springs with period photos of it in its heyday and items from the Water Carnival, Fort Stockton's annual celebration that started in 1936. A tour of the springheads and a look at the passages that lie beneath the historic pool will commence at 1:30. Visitors will not be going underground, but will be viewing the openings to the cave passages. To join the spring tour, please arrive at the Annie Riggs Museum no later than 1:30. The tour group will come convoy to the historic Comanche Springs bathhouse, which attracted thousands of swimmers and tourists every summer during its heyday. From 3 to 5 p.m., Ken Bachman, the West Texas Outlaw, will take the stage at the Annie Riggs Museum for Western and Cowboy Music. It will be a day for visitors and local residents to reflect on a rich history that includes many icons of the West and to capture new memories. The event is free of charge, courtesy of Texas Water Trade, a nonprofit organization that is working to restore Comanche Springs to year-round flows using voluntary water markets. Lenten Luncheons to be held. The churches of the Fort Stockton Ministerial Alliance came together each Tuesday to sponsor Lenten Luncheons in preparation for Easter. The first one of these will be held on March 8th at 11:45 a.m. in the Fellowship Hall of the First Presbyterian Church. The sponsors of the luncheon are the First Presbyterian Church and St. Stephen's Episcopal Church. The public is welcome to attend. Renovations a possibility for apartments by Megan Waring. To provide an affordable housing community, the Oasis Apartments in Fort Stockton will potentially undergo a complete rehab. At a special meeting held on February 23rd, the Fort Stockton City Council unanimously approved a $250 fee waiver for the rehabilitation of the Oasis Apartments. That waiver will aid Thomas Development Group in getting awarded tax credits for the project. By the March 1st deadline, JLG submitted a tax credit application to the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. One of the key components for that application is local government support and contribution for rural properties, such as a permit waiver. A fee waiver of $250 for application for rural subregions for the benefit of development will allow the application to qualify for that one point to meet that criteria. Housing prices and rental rates are skyrocketing across the state. Fair market rent prices in Pecos County are considered to be high compared to the national average. The FMR for a two-bedroom apartment in the county is $926 per month, while in the previous year, rent for a two-bedroom home was $898 per month. The Pecos County FMR area is more expensive than 83% of the state. Knowing that residents need an affordable housing option, the Oasis Apartments rehab would include 56 unit site improvements, building interiors, unit interiors, accessible units, and a new community building. For the site rehab, improvements will be made, including a new site entrance sign on the parking lot, and sidewalks will be repaved. Landscaping, a multipurpose community building with a barbecue grill for community gatherings outside. The building exteriors, all siding, windows, doors, along with the metal stairs will be replaced. The unit interiors will undergo a complete rehab as well. That will include new flooring, ceiling fans, cabinets, counters, and energy-efficient fixtures and appliances, along with new water heater, lighting, and vanity sinks. Applicants will be notified in June or July if they have received a tax credit award for funding. The tax credit award process is very competitive in the state.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, February 24th. City Council orders demolition of two dilapidated properties by March 4th. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A long-running code enforcement saga is drawing to a close as the Monahan City Council orders the demolition of two houses within 10 days. Meeting in regular session on Tuesday, The council held two public hearings on the properties located at 314 West 5th Street, owned by D.G. Smith, deceased, and 411 North Main, owned by Robert Garcia. And even though members of the community were present for the meeting, only one had a question for the council. Quote, "If these houses are demolished, who has to pay for it?" Jim Reeves said. City Manager Rex Thee answered by saying, quote, "If the owner doesn't comply with the order and demolish the house within 10 days, then the city will step in and demolish it. The city will then obtain a lien on the house for the cost of the demolition," end quote. After the public hearings on the properties were closed, the next two agenda items were to act on the findings and order regarding the properties. Based on the evidence Thee read during the hearing and the report submitted by Building Inspector Joel Melendez, it was determined the buildings were not safe based on the standards set by the Code of Ordinances. Quote, "Having found the structures unsafe and not occupied and may not be feasibly repaired, the owner will have 10 days to vacate the structure, which means to clear everything out of the home and off the property and to demolish the structure," Thee said. Along with Thee, present were council members Jeppy Wilson, Rudy Hernandez, Calvin Carroll, and Richard Hawkins, as well as Mayor Adam Steen. Councilmember Ivy Valenzuela was absent. In regular business, council members approved a lease agreement with Henry Cutbirth for hangars 1, 6, and 11. During the last council meeting, council members evoked their first right of refusal to purchase the hangars at Roy Hurd Memorial Airport, which were previously owned by Kenneth R. Schwab Estate. The hangars are privately owned, but on city land, so the city has first right of refusal before a hangar can be sold. Cutbirth recently purchased the hangars for a total of $80,000. Thee said Cutbirth has several hangars at the airport and will take care of them and already has plans of extensive renovations to the hangars. According to the lease, Cutbirth will pay the city 5 cents per square foot for the land, leased for an annual charge of $779 for all three hangars. The lease is for 10 years with the option to renew automatically for another 5 years unless the lessor notifies the city within 60 days before the expiration of the original terms granted. In other business, the city council members considered the city's first right of refusal to purchase airport hangar 12-8 from Kenny Dutcher. Quote, "Dutcher received an offer from IB Properties to purchase the hangar for $25,000, Thee said. Thee said it would add no benefit to the city to own the hangar, so he suggested the council evoke the first right of refusal and let IB Properties, represented by Cutbirth, purchase the hangar. In the final actionable agenda item, council members agreed to release old, uncollectible municipal liens. Quote, "Some of these liens date back to the 90s and have been determined to be uncollectible due to various reasons, like the ownership transferred to one or more local taxing entities, or the taxing entity sold the property without collecting the lien, or the property has been sold multiple times without collection of the lien. Releasing them will give them a better chance of being sold," Thee said. The total amount of the liens is $13,450. Quote, "The list of liens the city still has will be very carefully watched to make sure when the property is sold, the lien is collected by the new owner because the lien follows the land, not the owner," Thee said. The council will meet again on March 8th in the council chambers of City Hall, located at 112 West 2nd Street at 3 p.m. The meeting is open to the public. MEDC awarded $1 million FM Hall grant. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahan's Economic Development Corporation received a $1 million grant from the Florence Marie Hall Foundation for the broadband infrastructure project, Executive Director Ashley Adalto told board members in Tuesday's meeting. Quote, "The grant will either go toward extending phase two of the broadband project or providing service to residential homes. The broadband committee will make a decision for the funds in the near future," Adalto said. To date, MEDC has received $3.25 million in funds dedicated to the broadband project. The board also approved the outlay report and a request for reimbursement for the broadband project. The board has received $123,000 in reimbursement to date. Board members attending the meeting were Richard Irwin, Eddie Nelms, Hal Upchurch, and Brian Franks. Letitia Rodriguez was absent. In other business, the board approved a replat of Block 26 in the East Monahan subdivision. The commercial lot is located right off of Business 20, east of the Ward County Event Center. Quote, "The lot was originally over 5 acres, and replatting it into 5 smaller 1-acre lots will make it easier to sell," she said. "The lots will have a shared driveway, and water and sewer will be ready to go prior to the sale of the lots." Since the replat was approved by the MEDC board, it will need to be approved by Monahan City Council to be finalized. In other business, the board tabled approving an estimate for Monahan's Parkway intersection flooding conveyance in anticipation of receiving another bid for the project. In December, the project received a bid which was 3 times higher than expected. The bid was sent out to 5 companies, 2 of which said they don't have time, and 1 said they would not dig. Quote, "We got a bid from Brett Construction for $236,000, which is about $100,000 less than the previous bid," Adalto said. In other actions, Carol Faulkner presented the status of the broadband project, as well as the quarterly reporting associated with the $1.5 million federal EDA grant. "Last month, Faulkner reported that we were working along several avenues to obtain additional funding for the fiber infrastructure." Faulkner said, quote, "We are continuing efforts to raise the needed funding for reliable high-speed internet access, including efforts with the state of Texas. On behalf of Monahan's, last November, Monahan's Chamber of Commerce Director Teresa Burnett submitted a funding proposal to the newly created Texas Broadband Office. The Broadband Office has over $500 million available for rural broadband expansion, and the Monahan's project meets all of the criteria set forth in the funding guidelines," end quote. Shalom Equipment and their subcontractor, Robert Stitching, are continuing work on the Metro Ethernet loop that will feed the distribution system and drops that will ultimately connect subscribers to the network. The feeder consists of conduit, handholds, and large 144-count and 288-count fiber. Quote, "Vince Smith, superintendent for Shalom, says that they expect phase one, the initial 6-mile section of the feeder network, to be completed next month. The phase one infrastructure will feed the proposed fiber network from Interstate 20 on the south to Sealy on the north, Monahan's Parkway on the east to Highway 18 on the west," Faulkner added. Faulkner Consulting is working on design for the fiber distribution system, as well as network equipment design of the core optical elements and customer premise connections. Because the network equipment consists of processing units that require silicon processing chips, Faulkner said, quote, "The current supply chain shortage is of concern to the project. Nonetheless, we believe that the broadband project is on track to begin providing reliable high-speed internet in Monahans sometime this year, end quote. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable totaling $20,000, which included $6,000 for Zoom Prospector website renewal, $9,000 for payroll and salaries, and $4,900 for phone, insurance, maintenance, and fuel. The financial report reflecting a balance of $2.1 million in available funds and minutes of the January 24th regular meeting were approved. Alan Neese booked for punching and kicking girlfriend. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man was arrested last week on a Ward County warrant for allegedly assaulting his then-girlfriend last November. On November 28th, around 10:30 p.m., deputies were dispatched to the 1200 block of Ward Street in Piute in reference to an assault. According to Ward County Sheriff Ferran Vallier, quote, upon arrival, deputies observed a female victim with severe injuries to her face and head, end quote. The 35-year-old victim told deputies her boyfriend, Micah Alanese, age 29, of 412 West 11th Street, assaulted her by punching her multiple times with a closed fist and kicked her all about her face and body. Quote, the victim said Alanese kicked her in the head and she lost consciousness, and when she regained consciousness, he was gone, Valle said. A warrant for Alanese was subsequently issued, charging him with aggravated assault, causes serious bodily injury, a second-degree felony. Alanese was picked up on that warrant on February 16th and taken to Ward County Jail. A bond of $10,000 was set, and Alanese was released after posting the bond. If convicted, he could face 2 to 20 years in prison and or a fine of up to $10,000. Lemus arrested for attempting to hurt victim with pocket knife. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Jose Lemus Jr., age 38, of 2407 West 4th Street, was arrested and booked into the Ward County Jail on February 17th on two Ward County warrants, charging him with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and possession of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, both second-degree felonies. According to Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle, quote, deputies were called to the 2600 block of West 4th Street in reference to a disturbance in the 2400 block of West 4th Street. Once on scene, deputies spoke to Lemus, who was holding a box which he said contained drugs. Quote, at that point, deputies detained Lemus for further investigation, Valle said. The victim told deputies Lemus tried to kill her and utilized a pocket knife to assault her. Quote, the victim was able to flee from Lemus to the 2600 block of West 4th Street, where she then contacted authorities, he said. Upon further investigation, it was determined a crystallized substance suspected to be methamphetamine was inside the box Lemus was holding when officers arrived. Lemus was transported to Ward Memorial Hospital to be treated for, quote, a medical emergency, Valle said. For his personal safety, he was released from the hospital and not taken into custody at that time of the incident, but warrants were subsequently issued for his arrest. Bond was set at $10,000 for each charge, and Lemus was released after posting the $20,000 bond. If convicted, Lemus could face 2 to 20 years in prison and or a fine up to $10,000.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.